Did you know this? The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children actually stopped using the phrase stranger danger a few years ago. Not only are most abducted children taken by somebody they actually know, but a child in peril may in fact be able to find help by reaching out to some other adult, a police officer, a store clerk, a parent with kids in tow. For many adults, though, who grew up in the era of stranger danger rhetoric, the ghost of those warnings lives on. We may be all business with the folks who serve our morning coffee. We check ourselves out at the grocery store to avoid an encounter with another human being ringing up our purchases. We keep our headphones firmly on for an entire bus or train or plane ride to signal to our seatmate to not even try to spark up a conversation. Is it any wonder so many of us are chronically, toxically lonely? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. For a long time, studies about relationships and happiness focused on the folks we're closest to, our partners and families, our best friends and trusted confidants. But researchers are realizing we also benefit greatly from what are called minimal social interactions. These are little snippets of human connection with people we don't know well and may never even see again. The thing is, a lot of us are so out of practice that we don't even know where to start with these. Journalist Joe Kahane shares some ideas for this in his new book, The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Joe, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
So a lot of us did grow up being warned about the hazards of talking with strangers. Were those fears probably always exaggerated?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you said, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s in Boston, and I distinctly recall the parade of police officers who came through our classrooms warning us against literally everyone in the world that we haven't met. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about like stranger danger in its purest sense, it's that everyone you don't know is a threat to you. And, you know, they're acting out of what they thought was an abundance of caution. They thought they were responding to a real threat, but in reality, the vast majority of crimes then and now were perpetrated by people known to the victim. So in their zeal to protect children, they weren't really drawing on good data or any data at all. And we're starting to see now in a little bit of political science research that they may have actually poisoned an entire generation's ability to trust other people, which is a bad thing because trust is really important to like the health of societies.
Meanwhile, you say your parents are world champions at talking to strangers. What have you learned from their example?
Yeah, they're amazing. And both of them are still alive. They're in their late 70s now. I grew up watching them talk to everybody all the time. We grew up in Boston, like I said, and they were both unabashed about it, but not in a way that was mortifying to me. A lot of people I speak to and spoke to for this book who say they talk to strangers a lot all say that their teenage children are horrified when they do this. They want to crawl under a rock when they see their parents doing this. I didn't have that experience because I think, number one, Boston was a city of talkers in a lot of ways, so everybody's kind of talking. But number two, I saw how well it worked for them. I saw, you know, from my earliest days to the present, they were still making friends. And, you know, we see now with the epidemic of loneliness that people are telling surveys, you know, researchers more and more that they don't feel that they have any friends. They don't feel that they have any close confidants. I get to watch my parents for decades acquire friends over the entirety of their life. And they still do it today. They'll go on a trip and they'll come back and I'll get a call from my mother. And she'll just be like, you got to meet this lady. I met this amazing lady in Ohio. You got to talk to her. And then I'm on the phone with this lady. And sure enough, she's great. But yeah, they definitely inspired this book to us to a great degree.
So I want to talk about these things called minimal social interactions. How are these different from the chats we might have with a friend or a coworker we've known for years?
Yeah, they are, you know, they're minimal, like it says in the name. So they're done fleetingly. They're done in passing. They don't take forever. They're not, you know, really long and intense personal conversations, which you can still have with strangers, of course, but we usually reserve those for family and friends. And what they are basically is like a little chat with the person at the supermarket, a little chat when you're standing in line, a little chat with the barista in your coffee shop that goes beyond the usual mindless rote exchange that we have with people. So, I live in New York now. So there's a lot of people saying like, how you doing? And you say, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine too. And then you end it, right? No information has been exchanged. No one's really listening or talking. A minimal social interaction would be something that takes place in a context like that, but involves a little bit of connection, involves actual conversation. You know, it could start with just talking about the weather, and then maybe you talk a little bit about your day. You might have noticed something. But these things that we researchers hadn't studied you know, despite how common they can be, in the last 15 years, they've started to study them and they've found them to be quite beneficial to people's sense of well-being and to the way that they feel connected to the world around them.
I was out walking my dog last week, and I was on the sidewalk at a stop sign. This dirty old pickup truck pulls up to the stop sign, and the guy rolls down his window, and I think, oh boy, here we go. And what he said, he calls out the window and said, "Happy National Dog Day." And I said, oh, thank you so much. It just made my day. It was such a tiny thing, but it was really just a beautiful moment.
Yeah, that's a minimal social interaction. It's a testament to the power of dogs as like agents of socializing, because yeah. There is, you know, like, while you really can't tell anything about a person by the fact that they have a dog, besides the fact that they have a dog, dog owners feel much more comfortable talking to other dog owners, even when they're total strangers, than they would talking to someone who didn't have a dog. So it's kind of a testament to how little it takes to make us comfortable talking to people we don't know, as daunting as it might seem to us.
Okay, a few years ago, this group in England organized something that might sound like torture to a lot of people, but we'll just ask people to bear with us. Tell us about Chatty Bus Day.
Yeah, so you know, you mentioned loneliness, the problem of loneliness. There is an, you know, what experts are calling an epidemic of loneliness. And loneliness is really dangerous. It's really bad for society because it destroys trust and socializing. It's really bad for individuals. It registers on a physical and mental level. It's catastrophic when it hits a certain level. And it's at that level now. The U.S. hasn't been as good about trying to remedy this problem as the U.K. has. The U.K. has like an actual loneliness cabinet minister to try to find ways to like get people back in contact with other people to try to alleviate this problem. And the BBC is involved in this. And the BBC did Chatty Bus Day a few years ago. Now, in order to understand how radical Chatty Bus Day actually is, you have to understand how uncomfortable Londoners are talking to people on mass transit. Like there's a social norm against it. It's not really done, but they are, you know, when you mention even the prospect of that to Londoners, like they turn green at the prospect of talking to people on buses, on the tube, whatever. So the BBC just declared a day, Chatty Bus Day. And it was a day when everyone was allowed to talk to people on the bus, right? So they tried to push back against the social norm that usually keeps us, you know, forces us to keep to ourselves. And they just said, this is like a furlough day, you know, like you're free today. Everyone can talk. It's not a sign that you don't understand social norms or you're crazy or something. And it went really well. And even people who claim to be very shy, very introverted, found that it was much easier than they had anticipated, because, you know, we're led to believe that it's impossible, I think, in many ways. And they found that it made their commutes better and it made them feel less lonely and it made them feel more connected to where they live at a time of like great estrangement, right? Great alienation. It was, you know, overwhelmingly successful. And you know, I read a lot of the data coming out of it and people were just like shocked that they could talk to other people, that other people would be interesting to talk to. Like, this is how far we've drifted from one another. And so they continue, BBC continues to do programming like that. And there are a lot of organizations in England that continue to do stuff like that too, to try to get strangers to talk to each other in person. So it's pretty amazing, actually.
It turns out one problem a lot of us have is that we tend to assume people we don't know are what, less like intellectually deep than we think of ourselves as being, maybe not as smart.
Yeah, so the idea here is called lesser minds, and lesser minds is this idea that a psychologist named Nicholas Epley and another psychologist named Juliana Schroeder came up with, didn't come up with, they observed it in research. And what it is basically is it refers to a tendency that everyone seems to have to assume that strangers don't have like the same intellectual vividness we might have. They don't have the same willpower. They don't have the same capacity for secondary emotions, that sort of stuff. All the things that make us human. We tend to underestimate the degree to which strangers are people. Now, you know, generally this is like fairly harmless. You know, it's obviously not great to not think the people around you are fully people like you are. They're not special snowflakes like you are. But it's, you know, it's true, and it happens, and it happens to everybody, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender. You know, we see it all over the place. Generally, you know, it's just this kind of slightly harmless assumption, but under the right conditions and provoked a certain way, it can become dehumanization. It can be a monstrous and dangerous and destructive thing. But it really is the baseline when it comes to human interactions. And I think that's part of the reason why in all these, you know, I read so much research in this, talked to so many people to do this book. the reason why we expect so little from interactions with strangers is probably tied to this idea of lesser minds. Like, we're shocked that there's a person in there, you know, in a lot of ways. It doesn't make us bad people to assume that. It's just this strange quirk of human psychology. But it also, you know, leads to great success when people do make an effort to talk to strangers, because they're always pleasantly surprised that the person they talk to is interesting and has a unique perspective and is smart and is engaging and is, you know, lovely to chat with. And that's overwhelmingly the case in a lot of the research that people have done on this.
Joe Cahane, you actually took a 42-hour train ride specifically for the purposes of chatting people you had never met before and would probably never see again. How did you make yourself available for conversations and let people know that you were up for talking?
Yeah, you don't really have a choice when you're on a train. So, you know, Chris, like part of the my personal journey is part of this book of me trying to build myself up as like as social a creature as my parents. So like starting from zero with little interactions and then just getting like more and more audacious and more challenging as I go. So, you know, for the train thing, I wanted to put myself in a situation where I would not know anyone. And there would be like a culture of talking to strangers, right? But a very intense way where we're all in a metal tube together for a very long time. And so I booked the Southwest Chief, which goes from Chicago to LA. And yeah, it was about 44 hours or so. And there is no real choice on making yourself available. You are available when you're on the train, right? Like it's really social, and the people who ride those trains really like that part of it. It's part of their vacation, the train part, you know, a couple of days of just hanging out and looking out the window and meeting people and chatting with people. You could hide in your, you know, you could probably hide in your little apartment or a little compartment thing and not talk to anybody. But by and large, you have to be out there and you have to be social. So as a lone traveler I went alone, I would walk into the dining car or the observatory car, and I would just be waved over by somebody. You know, when you take these trains, they're all four top tables, you know, three people are sitting there, you walk in, you're the only one, like you're going to eat dinner with those people and you're going to talk and you're going to do it for hours. And I really, the prospect of that kind of stressed me out a little bit, because what if you get stuck at a table full of bores and then now you're going to have to make small talk for 4 hours. But I remember my first night, I walked in to the dining car and I was waved over to a table, and at the table were this older couple from South Carolina named Penny and I forget her husband's name, I'm so sorry. But Penny and her husband Bill, Penny and Bill, and they were marvelous. They were so funny, they were so interesting, their lives were wild, they had really interesting stories, and we just talked about everything forever, for like several hours. Just sat there, had a little wine, ate what they pass off as food on Amtrak, and it was marvelous. And so you think about this, you know, a lot of the things that stress people out about talking to strangers is if they're from different places or they're different groups. You know, the two of them came from a military background. They're from the South. I'm from the Northeast, obviously. And we connected so quickly and so easily, and they were just wonderful. And I'm still in touch with Penny today, actually. But it's great that you're compelled to do it, and it's great that the rules allow it, because one of the big hangups people have is that they don't think they're allowed to talk to people, you know, particularly in like an urban environment. So to go into a place like this that's hyper social and everyone knows it, that this is the law of the land, basically, it relieves a lot of the anxiety that people might feel about talking to strangers. And it's a really good way to practice. Like for me, it was a great way to listen and ask questions.
Well, it is true, Joe, that depending on how densely populated a community is, there comes a point at which talking to too many strangers would make it impossible to get anything else done. Can you explain the concept of civil inattention?
Yeah. So civil inattention is something that comes from another concept that they call overload, and that's tied to population density. So if you live in a city like New York or London or, you know, like a busy, crowded city, there are so many people around that to stop and process each one would make your head explode. Like we just don't have, you know, we don't have it in us to engage with that many people. And because they're moving quickly and because you see a lot of strangers all the time, it ends up creating a norm against talking to people. Like, you know, the default becomes not talking to people. Civil inattention is this really interesting thing that developed in cities where you're not talking to people, right? Like you're steering out of people's way. You're not, you know, buttonholing them in the street and asking them questions. You are passing them, but while you're passing them, you're making eye contact. You're acknowledging that they're there. And so the theory on civil inattention is that as you walk past someone, It's a way to register that you see them, that you're aware of them, you're not ignoring them, that they're not being ostracized by you, that sort of thing. You recognize them, you recognize that you're sharing a space, you're sharing a sidewalk together, and you're showing that I have nothing to fear from you and you have nothing to fear from me. And it's a really interesting way to say that, like, though we're not going to interact, we're still going to recognize each other. The work that was done on civil inattention was kind of 60s and 70s. I think it was probably much more common then than it is now. I think the smartphone probably eroded that part of, like, urban interaction, to the point where my usual experience is that people just don't look at each other at all on the streets now. And you know, by and large, they're listening to their earbuds or they're looking at their phones.
Yeah. And it even happens, like, in buildings, you know, people are on their phones as they move through a space. And I guess I always assume that they must have a lot more important things going on in their life than I do, who don't need to be looking at a phone. I mean, should we interpret, if someone's on their phone walking down a hallway or walking down the street, should we go out of our way to be like, hi, or just leave them to their own devices? Could we make their day better by saying hello, or are they signaling that they don't want that?
They're signaling that they don't want it, for sure. But I think there's also a component there where people, I think our social skills have eroded so much as a result of the smartphone that the prospect of interacting with strangers has become very intimidating to us. So we're hiding in our phones. It's like if you go to a bar and you walk into a bar and there are like 10 people lined up all looking at their phones, you know, they probably would really enjoy interacting with each other, but it's stressful now because they're kind of out of practice. You know, for me, I got pretty good at this stuff. I talk to a lot of people who are great at it. The ones who are brilliant at it, the ones who are like ninjas of like freestyle social interaction, can pick off someone regardless of what they're doing. They'll go up to someone with headphones on. They'll go up to someone with a phone on. And they're so confident and they're so engaging that the person, while, you know, initially they might be slightly annoyed, but then they'll be like, okay, yeah, I'll take the ride. I'll talk to this person. For people who are just kind of starting out on this, I would say avoid doing that in the street. But if you're in like a social place, if you're in a public place, like a coffee shop or a bar or something like that, I think you can do it. And I think people just woefully underestimate how enjoyable it can be. You know, we've really been poisoned against these interactions to a really harmful degree. And once you get past those initial misgivings, you know, the research backs this up, and the million people I talked to for this book back it up as well, that it tends to go very well. It tends to be better than not talking.
So first things first, of course, we have to let the other person know and know from them that, as you said, we mean no harm to one another. You need to let somebody know that you're not sidling up to them to grab their purse and run. I was fascinated to read, though, that people in rural areas tend to score lower on assessments of generalized trust than people in urban areas. And first of all, talk about why that might be the case.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to nail down because trust is such a tricky thing. But I think in a small town, you're probably going to have a more homogenous population. It's going to be more stable. You're going to have less traffic of people from the outside world. You'll have less opportunities to engage with people whose, you know, lives might be radically different from your own. You know, theoretically, in a city, you do have more opportunities to be reassured about the humanity of people from different groups just because you're mingling with them all the time. And so, you know, I think the strongest idea, the strongest explanation for that sort of thing is probably that. But it's, you know, it's really interesting to consider as well that small towns tend to be more social with strangers. It tends to be the norm to talk to people in a way that it isn't in the city. So you get this kind of funny this funny paradox of places with lower trust but more likelihood to talk to strangers, and places with higher trust and a lower likelihood to talk to strangers.
How might our geographic location on the planet and the corresponding risk of certain kinds of infections shape the way we relate to strangers without realizing it on any conscious level?
Yeah, so this is called parasite threat or pathogen threat theory. And the idea is that, you know, this is one of the fields where people are trying to figure out how certain cultures end up being more xenophobic and certain cultures end up being less xenophobic. And the idea behind pathogen threat is that there's a great deal of research that has tied certain cultural characteristics to the prevalence of infectious disease in a place. So places with higher levels of infectious disease, they're going to be hotter, they're going to be more humid places. Those places tend to have more what we would call traditional societies, so more family-based, more close friends, more wary of outsiders, That sort of thing. So, you know, over time, that can turn into the predominant culture, even as groups grow and societies get bigger. The places that tend to crop up around, you know, around the equator, basically tend to have more characteristics of those sorts of traditional or sorts of, I guess, traditional societies. Whereas when you go further north into the northern latitudes, there are lower levels of infectious disease and more liberalism, a lower incidence of like xenophobia. They tend to be less wary of outsiders. They tend to be more, you know, prize equality between men and women, that sort of thing. So sort of progressive cultures tended to pop up in northerly latitudes. And also there's an argument attached to this too, that when we made a lot of progress against infectious diseases after World War II, after the middle of the 20th century, it led to a pretty broad-based liberalization of a lot of societies because people didn't have to worry about infectious disease anymore. And it really makes sense. It makes sense how it would be adaptive for a culture to avoid outsiders when there's a high level of infectious disease, because they could literally be carrying disease. They could infect your group. They could kill your group with whatever they're carrying. So it makes sense. But yeah, it's interesting to see how that kind of expands out to create, you know, a whole culture.
Well, and I realize that you're a journalist and not a social scientist yourself, but do you have a hypothesis about how the pandemic might be affecting societal behaviors these days?
Yeah, I think it's too soon to tell. You know, cultural evolution is a thing that usually takes place over many years. You know, like pathogen threat was something that would play out over centuries in order to create the effect that it had. I think from what I've seen, what I've read, kind of early research on what the pandemic did to us, certainly at its peak, and I understand we're at a peak again now, it definitely made people very wary of strangers. I spent the whole pandemic in New York City. And so I can attest in the early weeks of that, and in the spring of last year, you know, people were crossing the street to avoid each other. It's less like that now. I think it became a little more normal, and people also realized that, like, you know, not only is that kind of overreaction, it's also sort of rude to the person you're walking by being like, get away from me, disease right. carrier. So people in New York, anyways, when I was there, made a real effort to like wave to each other, to arch their eyebrows, to say hello, you know, through their masks, just to, you know, recognize that we're both here. We're not afraid of each other. We're just doing this for the greater good, which I found that really beautiful. I think, you know, one of the things that's going to have a longer tail coming out of this is just, you know, the way we socialize. I think people have a lot of anxiety about returning to life with other people, life with strangers, life with coworkers, to dealing with that sort of, you know, to dealing with the challenges of being a social animal again after a year and a half of just being behind a computer screen. You know, those of us who are fortunate enough not to work on the front lines, I see that and hear that a lot, that people they're worried about going back to work, not only because they're afraid of getting the coronavirus, but because they fear that they're not going to be good at this anymore, that they forgot how to be social, that they forgot how to do these interactions that, you know, require a great deal of engagement, that require you to be quick and listen and pay attention in a way that you don't have to when you're just living on digital platforms.
All right, Joe, I have to say, I was raised to always assume that authority figures of any kind in my world probably had better things to do than talking to me, and that I should be really careful about not irritating or interrupting people. So give us some general guidelines. Broadly speaking, under what circumstances should we consider ourselves free to talk to strangers?
Yeah. So I would say if you're at a party or something like that, you're gathered in a place, you're at a game, you know, you're gathered in a place for one express purpose. It could be church, whatever, you don't know someone, like being in the same room for the same reason gives us permission to talk to strangers. I think beyond that, you want to look at good public places. You want to look at, you know, parks, safe parks that are comfortable, that have people hanging around. You could do it in bars. You could do it in coffee shops, you know, places where people are comfortable. They're sitting, you know, they're feeling relaxed. Those tend to be open places. Libraries, you know, don't talk inside the library, but, you know, if there's a cafe area or something like that, it tends to be pretty open. Those are the places, you know, especially in daylight, do it in daylight. Don't go try to talk to someone on the street in the middle of the night. Don't sneak up on people, all that stuff. But yeah, if people are looking to start out, great places to do it are places like that. And sometimes contexts like just having a chat with the person serving you coffee or talking to the waitress at the diner that you're eating at, those sorts of things. Those are really good places to practice, to rebuild those social muscles. And then as you get better at it, you could do it in other places as well. But that's a great way to start.
And when you say talking to, it's really about listening to, like, we don't want to go up to somebody and give them the TED talk of our impressions of all of our life lessons, right?
Yeah, that's sort of the irony of this whole thing, and I found this again and again and again as I interviewed people who advocate for this or people who study it, is that the paradox of talking to strangers is that your key to success is going to be not talking. It's going to be listening. It's going to be noticing. It's going to be not filibustering, right? So I come from like loudmouth people who talk a lot. It takes a lot of training for me to learn to really listen and resist the temptation to filibuster and resist the temptation to just listen for something I'm personally interested in and then grab onto it and steer the conversation towards that. When you begin to get really good at this, you have to relinquish control of the conversation to a great degree. That's very uncomfortable for me, and it's very uncomfortable for a lot of people, which is you notice something, you ask a question, and then it's all about the other person. You just let the other person talk. If you're going to ask a question, it's just to help them articulate what they're saying, help them get at what they want to talk about. These are open-ended questions, so it's not just like how on earth could you think that? It's more like what got you there? You know, where are you from? Those sorts of things. Why did that make you feel the way it made you feel? And then just listening. You know, a great rule to start with is something that I got from an organization called Urban Confessional in LA, where they just put people on the street with cardboard signs saying free listening, and people come up and tell them things. And I did it, and I was so skeptical of it, and it went extraordinarily well. It's one of the most poignant things I've ever done. But free listening teaches something called the 80-20 rule, which is only talk about yourself 20% of the time. You know, only talk about yourself to maybe disclose something about yourself that might be similar to their experience to show that you understand, or you know, just to connect a little bit so it doesn't feel like an interrogation. And then once the conversation really gets started, you can talk about yourself a little bit more. But I found it to be immensely valuable training to not talk, to just like make eye contact, watch body language, try to understand what they were saying, try to understand where they were coming from. And those interactions for me were could be staggeringly beautiful, really funny, really unexpected, really enriching, and the sorts of things that I you know, I carry with them. I carry them with me to this day.
You use this technique known as echoing, and there was one conversation where it sounded like it was about to go south fast, but it turned out to be one you really liked.
Yeah, it was so when I started getting really good at this, I started getting a little more audacious and avant-garde. And I knew at the end, the thing that I needed to do was I needed to start talking to people on the subway in New York City. And a guy came in, and you know, there's this funny thing that happens when you do talk to people a lot. You get this vibe that attracts other people to come talk to you. So I was in this strange mode where people were just talking to me without me having to really do anything. And other people who do this said the same thing happened to them. You just have this kind of energy. It's strange. But he sat down, and I kind of leaned. I, you know, just said, "Hey, how you doing?" And he kind of nodded. And we're sitting there, but you could feel like there was some kind of interest. And then this woman gets up, and he was just like, "You know, that's the kind of woman I like." And I was like, "Oh God, here we go. This is going to be disgusting." And so, but instead of being like, "Ugh, okay, I'm going to move to the other side of the train," I just started echoing, which is, you know, one of the techniques that I was taught. So I was like, "That's the kind of woman you like." And he was like, "Yeah." And so he just started talking more, and I just kept asking open-ended questions, and it got back to his mother. And this is going to sound very Freudian, obviously, but the reason why he liked people who are kind of like what we would consider imperfect, or what the culture would consider imperfect. He loved that because his mother, who he adored, became obsessed with aging. She was aging, she had emphysema, she smoked a lot, and she started getting a lot of work done to try to regain like perfection, to try to regain her youth. And for him, it really disturbed him, and it freaked him out that he you know, increasingly couldn't recognize his own mother. And so his idea of the line he had was imperfection is meaning. You know, when you see someone with like bodily imperfections, that's meaning, that's life. When you don't see that, it freaks him out. And he ended up telling me the whole story of his life. He was an immigrant from Puerto Rico. You know, this the really sad end of his mother, who was killed when one of the hurricanes hit there. The power went out and took down her respirator with it. But it was an extraordinary conversation with this guy, who is from a completely different world than me. And we really connected, and I really it was really intense and really meaningful. And at the end of it, we shook hands, and he just took one of my hands in both of his hands and said, "Thank you for talking to me," and then got off on our stops, and we'll never see each other again. But
Wow.
But it was magic. It's like a magic trick. It's remarkable.
What is it about giving a stranger that you're chatting with a little bit of personal information about yourself that helps them open up so much?
Yeah, it's this is a really interesting bit of research too, but there's a lot of research now on matching disclosures, right? So when we say something personal, they tend to say something personal. We've always been, you know, provided it's appropriate, right? Like, I can't go up to some stranger in the street and like, just be like, let me tell you about my mother. It has to be appropriate. You have to like calibrate to each other. You have to follow each other. It's kind of a dance. But when we say something personal, what does it do? It shows the other person that we trust them. We trust them enough to maybe give them something a little sensitive. It shows that we don't think that they're going to like make fun of us or something like that. We're comfortable. It makes us like them. It makes them like us a little bit more, and it makes it much more likely that they will share something personal at the same level that we just did. And you kind of follow each other down. And I think we've always been, you know, everyone has been in a situation in a plane or on a bus or on a train where you just end up in that sort of conversation where you're having like a meaning of life conversation with a total stranger. And I think part of it is inhibitions are lifted when you're relatively sure you're never going to see each other again, right? Like this, whatever you tell this person is not going to follow you home. It's not going to be on social media. It's not going to come back to haunt you. It's, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're sinking it to the bottom of the ocean. But there's also kind of an evolutionary aspect to it where because we're so social, because the key to the success of humans is to be social, is to grow our social networks, to make more contacts, to make more friends, to find mates and all those things. We have these kind of mechanisms within us that facilitate the formation of new friendships. And that's one of them. So, you know, sometimes you meet a new friend and you just have a great conversation that goes deeper than you might have expected. And then, you know, provided you're going to see each other again, that's a friend. You've made a friend and you benefit from having friends. You benefit emotionally, but you also benefit practically in that you gain access to their friends and you gain access to what they know and their companionship and all that stuff. But it's really interesting. I hadn't given it a lot of thought before I did the book, but I did a deep dive in the research and you see that it really is useful. It's key to the, in many ways, it's key to the flourishing of humans.
So many of us have had pleasant interactions with strangers who we discover are on the other side of the political fence from us and really liked them until we found this thing out about them. Is it okay to avoid these controversial questions and just connect with another human whose politics we might not agree with?
Yes, I think if you want to have a fruitful discussion about a hot button political issue with someone who is on the opposite side, you can't start with that. If you do meet someone new and you're just like, abortion, what do you think? You know, that's not going to go anywhere. Right? That conversation is doomed out of the gate. In order to get to a place where you can have that conversation in a productive way, you have to connect in a non-political way first. You have to connect as people. This is the work of a group called Braver Angels that like teaches people to do this, to talk to people across the aisle. But you have to talk about how you both have dogs. You have to talk about your grandkids, what your parents were like. Get comfortable in the company of the other person. Feel that maybe you can trust them a little bit. Maybe you like them a little bit, but you know that you can talk. And once you know that you can talk, and you're looking at each other, you're recognizing the humanity and the individuality of the person across from you, then you can start to move into more difficult issues. But I think the critical mistake everyone makes is just being like, oh yeah, you're from Louisiana. What are your thoughts on gun control? Mm. And then you're doomed. You're stuck.
The new book by journalist Joe Kahane is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Joe, this has been really interesting. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Chris. I was really glad you gave me a call.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is free where you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.